This is Tim Arson, a.k.a. El Toro Maniaco, a.k.a. The Arsonist. And you're listening to The Sound Off with the Solo Monster. And there's also another monster, the Zombie. Brains!
It is my favorite holiday of the year. Oh yes, this is a special Halloween edition of the Solo Monster Sounds Off, episode 188, here for Sunday, October 30th, 2011. I am the Solo Monster, the one day a year when my name actually makes a whole lot of sense. I am a little under the weather, so I apologize in advance if I sound a little nasal at any point during the show, but I really could not miss. I mean, how could I miss the Halloween show? There's only one time per year that I could actually do this. And like I said earlier, my favorite holiday. I didn't go out this year for it, but I know some of you did. So hopefully everybody stayed safe and had a good time. And we're going to get to a lot of different things on this show, including TNA, WWE. No ROH, unfortunately. I did not get a chance to see the show. But the first thing I want to do is thank everybody who took the time to download, listen to, and send feedback on episode 187 of the Sound Off last week. Earlier in the week, actually, is when it went up. That was my double interview. Interview with the prodigy Nathan Banner, who is an independent star on the rise. And, of course, the reigning Ring of Honor World Television Champion. That's right, the ROH TV Champion was interviewed right here on this show by yours truly, Jay Lethal, also former X Division Champion at TNA, had some very interesting comments with respect to TNA wrestling. So for those of you who did not have a chance to listen to the interview, go back and check it out. It's definitely worth your time. It's also up on YouTube right now. So if you don't want to download it, you can go to my official YouTube channel. My username on there is The Solo Monster, all one word, no spaces. And episode 187 is up there for those of you who would prefer to listen to it that way. Speaking of YouTube, I would suggest that if you are not a subscriber to my channel, that you do so right now. And I'll tell you why a little bit later on. I'll have a little surprise for you guys coming up next weekend, but we'll get to that a little bit later. First things first, let's talk about TNA. And TNA making some big news yet again this week. Of course, I talked about Bound for Glory. Kurt Angle had beaten Bobby Roode to retain the TNA World Heavyweight Championship, and then at the very next set of tapings, he proceeded to lose the championship to James Storm. That was not the original plan. It was Hulk Hogan. He had gotten the outcome changed at the pay-per-view, and, of course, took great joy, along with Eric Bischoff, in mocking the internet wrestling community. We're a bunch of marks. You know, we don't see the big picture. Blah, 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 blah. Who cares? Anyway, the World Championship now in TNA is apparently much like the WWF title in late 1999, ironically when Vince Russo was booking the product then. And again, Vince Russo may not be the head writer in TNA, but he is still writing the TV show. So I have no doubt in my mind that he had his hand in this. And the championship has changed hands like a hot potato yet again. This is, of course, spoilers. I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, know about this by now. But if not, don't say I didn't warn you. And let's be honest here. If you really don't want to hear about TNA spoilers, then why the hell are you listening to a wrestling podcast? Why are you even going to wrestling websites? Just don't do that. So anyway, at the tapings in Macon, Georgia, they were on the road again, and this will be airing on November 3rd. So not this upcoming... actually, I guess it is this upcoming Thursday. What am I talking about? Bobby Roode defeats James Storm to win the TNA title after Roode turned heel during the match. He clobbered his tag team partner with a beer bottle to win the championship, went heel, apparently got a pretty good reaction from the crowd, and on that same show, Gail Kim and Madison Rayne actually won the TNA Knockouts tag team titles, defeating Tara and Brooke Tessmacher. And perhaps the biggest news of all, Ronnie from the Jersey Shore appears for a segment on Impact with who else but Eric Young. And this leads to a tag team match the following week. It'll be Ronnie and Eric Young beating Robbie E and Rob Terry. again, who cares? You know, they've had a couple of Jersey Shore people there before. Once WWE brought in Snooki, the biggest Jersey Shore star of them all at WrestleMania, you really can't go any higher than that, and whatever. They brought Ronnie in, he did some stuff. It's not going to mean a damn thing. Skipping ahead a little bit here, they had another TV taping. This is for the show that airs on November 10th. And keep in mind, after already blowing off their first meeting for free on Impact, they do a rematch of sorts with Bobby Roode and James Storm on this show. Storm gets jumped backstage. He still tries to go out there valiantly to do the match. Goes out to the ring, goes after Bobby Roode, and apparently then collapses in a heap. AJ Styles, Kazarian come out, and I guess Bobby Roode kind of feigns concern at first, pretends to be all concerned about his former friend, tries to help him up, rolls him up for the pin, and then runs away. And AJ Styles challenges him after the match for the next pay-per-view, and then Sting, who of course is the new GM, got to have an authority figure, Sting comes out, makes the match official. So the main event of the Turning Point pay-per-view on November 13th will be Bobby Roode against AJ Styles. The same AJ Styles, mind you, that Hulk Hogan on the radio just a couple of weeks ago said, yeah, I don't know what to do with him. The guy just basically insinuating he can't get over, and you know, that's why he's not the top guy in TNA. So basically, AJ Styles is going to be a placeholder. Obviously, James Storm will be back at some point. When, I don't know. There's some talk he may not be back until after the new year. So AJ Styles, I guess, will just be another challenger fed to Bobby Roode in the meantime. And mind you, this match is made in the final segment of the Go Home show to air only 3 days before the pay-per-view. That's how important this AJ Styles-Bobby Roode match is to TNA. As far as my thoughts on putting the title on Bobby Roode, they should have done it at the pay-per-view. Obviously, they're trying to spike, no pun intended, a rating. And on the one hand, here's the thing about TNA. People love to bash TNA for a lot of different reasons. God knows I do it myself. But when I do it, I feel like there's justification for doing so. I don't just bash TNA just for the sake of bashing TNA. And TNA is indebted to Spike TV. Without Spike TV's support, without Spike TV's money, without Spike TV's time slot on Thursday nights, there is no TNA. TNA will cease to exist. So they, in their minds, think it's very important to do as well as they can do in the ratings, even more so, even at the expense of their pay-per-view shows. So on the one hand, I kind of get that. You know, Spike TV is their master, and they have to serve their master, and they have to do everything in their power to make sure those ratings don't dip below a certain point. But if that's the case, then why even bother doing pay-per-views? If ever there was a time for a company, whether it be WWE or TNA, to actually grow a set of balls and stand up and say, you know what? Pay-per-views are not just done because that's the way things are. Pay-per-views have to be done for a reason. You do them to make money. And if they're not making money, then you don't do them. It's an expense that is unnecessary. So TNA is in a position where they can stand up and say, you know what? Ratings are very important to us. We care very deeply about the numbers we do on Thursday nights. So from now on, we're not going to do pay-per-views anymore. Or instead of doing 12 pay-per-views, I guess they have one per month, we're going to cut that back to 6 or something like that. At least if they did that, I'd have more respect for them. But in their mind, and Eric Bischoff, you know, pay-per-views, that's just the way things are in wrestling. You have a wrestling company, you have to have pay-per-views. And of course, TNA does not give a shit. Their pay-per-views do awful numbers. In fact, Bound for Glory, the preliminary estimates on that show have it pegged between 20 and 25,000 buys on pay-per-view, which by TNA standards is above normal, but by Bound for Glory standards is actually down at least 5 to 10,000, if not more, from what they did last year. And this is a show that had Hulk Hogan's return to the ring against Sting in a match they've been building for 2 years. Not a good sign. Not a good sign. Turning Point isn't going to come close to doing even Bound for Glory numbers. So they continuously give this shit away for free on TV. As a fan, I mean, who cares, right? You know, why should we as fans care about the business side of TNA? Who gives a fuck if they're making money off pay-per-view? They're giving you championship matches on free TV. That is true. But at what cost? You know, to give Bobby Roode and James Storm away the way they did, you know, on television. I haven't seen the match yet. It hasn't aired. I'm sure it's actually a pretty good match. Their first encounter, not the second one. We'll find out this Thursday, but this is a company that doesn't know what they're doing. This is a company that apparently, if you read the tweets from Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan, who were the real power brokers in that company, and who just re-signed apparently for another 2 years with TNA, they love to go out there and they love to make the internet wrestling fans look dumb. And these are the two people booking your wrestling company. Not a good sign. Not a good sign. Now, Bobby Roode is the champion. He's a heel. You know, considering what TNA did at the pay-per-view, again, I would have had Bobby Roode beat Kurt Angle. That was the original plan, and Hulk Hogan got that plan changed. And I said right here on the Sound Off, you can't change what's already been done. They already fucked it up. But if I were in control, one scenario that I might explore is, over time, Bobby Roode grows increasingly jealous of James Storm and paranoid and feels that he got screwed out of being the world champion. And ultimately, he goes heel, turns on James Storm, probably feuds with him for a couple of months over the championship. In a way, that's what TNA did here. But of course, what TNA did was they condensed 3 to 6 months' worth of storylines and build-up into essentially one show. That's basically what they did. Now, WWE is just as guilty as they are. Because WWE, God knows, look at the CM Punk stuff with him and Triple H and all that. You had something that could have been dragged out for months, and it wouldn't have been boring. You could have dragged it out for months and kept it exciting each and every week, and they just couldn't help themselves, but they blow their load at once, and then you're left with nothing. And essentially, that's what TNA did here. They had something that could have been pretty special, and basically, they just couldn't help themselves, and they got rid of it. They took it, they flushed it down the toilet, so now what? You know, how long is James Storm going to be out for? Who knows? He'll be out for a little while. Bobby Roode can defend the championship, maybe beat a couple of people, look a little bit stronger. When Storm returns, maybe they could do something special. But it's just frustrating. You know, I know Hulk Hogan has done interviews and say, you know, you can't do things the way they used to be done in wrestling. He loves to give this example. I've heard this in multiple interviews, where if Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant were feuding in 2011, brother, you know, they'd start their feud at 9 o'clock, and by 11 o'clock, they'd have the match, and it would be over. And yes, that is what TNA would do. And in some respects, that is what WWE would do. But to say that it can't be done the old way because things are different, prove to me why it can't be done that way. What evidence is there that you couldn't take a storyline and drag it out over the course of a couple of, I'm not even saying a year. I mean, yeah, it's not 1988. It's not 89, the mega powers, you can drag that whole shit out for a year. I'm not even saying drag it out for a year. You mean to tell me you can't get 3 or 4 months worth out of something like this? I mean, you have ADD so badly, you just cannot stop yourself from doing that. I find that incredibly hard to believe. So that's my thoughts on TNA doing what they did. I can't comment beyond that because I just haven't seen it yet. That's the thing with TNA, they tape these shows and, you know, they put them in the can, and they don't air for 2 or 3 weeks. It feels old, but until I have a chance to see it in execution on TV, I won't fully judge it. But no matter what happens on TV, what they did was pretty fucking stupid. And the one thing TNA can actually be thankful for, another big piece of news that broke this week, involves Bellator, which is an MMA promotion that has been bought by Viacom, which, of course, is the parent company. They own Spike TV, among other properties. TNA falls under that umbrella. There's been a lot of talk with UFC moving off of Spike TV, signing their new deal with Fox. What is the future of men's programming and kind of the fighting type of shows on Spike TV? Could this be bad news for TNA? Because, again, TNA relies very heavily on Spike TV. If they found themselves off the network, then they're officially dead. And Bellator is a promotion that is, I guess, now the de facto number 2 mixed martial arts promotion in the country. They have been bought by Viacom. They are going to be debuting on Spike TV, but not until 2013. That is because the deal that has expired now with UFC, there's a clause in that contract, very smart clause, that I assume Dana White and the UFC people had put in there, that says that the network cannot air any competing MMA programming for 1 year until, you know, from the day that they leave the network. So Spike is going to be airing a lot of old UFC shows that they have the rights to and all that over the course of the next year. Bellator cannot be on the network until 2013. And, you know, on the one hand, it's a great deal for Bellator. It really puts them on the map. And for TNA, they should be ecstatic because this shows that Spike is not completely abandoning that type of programming. I don't know what other shows they're going to bring to the network if they want to try to supposedly they want to try to get more women watching the network. It's not going to turn into a women's network, but what TNA can rest easy knowing is that Spike is not completely abandoning their whole, you know, network for men type of concept. For Bellator, though, it kind of sucks because a year is a long time. A year is a very long time. And you could talk about all the wonderful things we're going to do, but you now have over 12 months to kill before your show. Right now they have a show on, I believe, on MTV2 in a pretty horrible time slot. They don't do big ratings at all. They do maybe a couple of 100,000 viewers every week. They're going to have to continue doing that until they go to Spike. And again, a year is a long time. A lot could happen in a year. But for the time being, it's a big deal for them, and TNA should breathe a sigh of relief, because as long as they could keep their 1.0 and 1.1 and 1.2... And by the way, I think I said this last week, I don't take any pride in this, well, maybe I do, but they did that big rating for the Impact post Bound for Glory, which, again, is the same thing that happened last year. When Jeff Hardy won the championship, he turned heel. I think Impact did one of the, if not the biggest rating it ever did last year, after all that, you know, 10-10-10 promotion and everything. And this year they did another big rating, one of their biggest ratings ever for Impact. And there were people who said, you know, there were people on SCScoops.com when I posted the mailbag, you know, they jumped on me as though I'm the head of editorial content for the website. Well, you didn't post about, you know, TNA doing a big rating. Obviously, you know, you're a WWE whore, and, you know, any good news about TNA, you're not going to report. Of course, number one, the news did go up a couple of days later. Number two, I'm not in charge of that. And number three, as I predicted, it was a one-week anomaly, because the TNA ratings were right back down to their usual levels this week. They couldn't even maintain it for an additional week. I think the rating this week was a 1-0 or a 1-1, which is, you know, hey, that's right in their average. But for all the people who thought that one week they did a 1.35, wow, this is going to be the sign of a big turnaround, it didn't mean shit. It was curiosity coming off the pay-per-view. The only way they're ever going to build their ratings is by taking something like a James Storm versus Bobby Roode thing and building it out and making people care about it. And they can't even do that right. So I just figured I would point that out. Some sad news this week. We found out that Barry Windham was hospitalized after suffering what is believed to have been a heart attack, although there's been some debate as to whether or not he may have suffered a stroke and a heart attack. Of course, Windham, he's, I believe, 51 years of age. I've heard 50 and 51. Was hospitalized in the intensive care unit at a Florida hospital. He was found, apparently, by Mike Rotundo, who, of course, was once upon a time his tag team partner. Together, they were the U.S. Express team for a while in the mid-'80s WWF. And, in fact, they had a match at the very first WrestleMania where they lost the tag team championship to the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff. And Rotundo, by the way, is a backstage agent for WWE. He's IRS, for those of you who maybe know him better. Apparently, he was the one who found Windham, called for an ambulance. They took him to the hospital. It was actually Windham's father, Blackjack Mulligan, who also has been suffering from a lot of health ailments over the last several years, who was posting updates on Facebook, letting everybody know what was going on. At one point, he claimed that his son was near death. It wasn't looking very good. And thankfully, he seems to have taken a turn for the better. He'll have a long road to recovery ahead of him. But Windham is a guy who was a big, big star, but could have been a lot bigger even than he was. A lot of people were commenting, I don't know who this person is. And it's kind of sad, but you kind of understand it. If you have people who were not wrestling fans back in the 80s or the early 90s, very young fans, probably would not know who Barry Windham is. He's not revered like some of the really big stars were, but Barry Windham may go down as one of the best in-ring performers in the history of the business, and he could have done a lot more than he did. He had some great matches with a ton of different guys, feuds with Ric Flair and Lex Luger, Dusty Rhodes. I mean, in WWF, he never really was as big of a single star as he was in the NWA. In fact, he had a run, at least one, actually probably multiple runs, in WWF in the mid-90s. They brought him in around 96 as this character called the Stalker. And by that point, he was out of his prime. He wasn't in the best of shape. It was a terrible gimmick, just a ridiculous gimmick that went nowhere. He would come to the ring with this camo face paint on. It was just atrocious. And I think he also was part of the new Blackjacks tag team with JBL about maybe a year or two after that. So it didn't make as big of an impact in WWF, but definitely made an impact on the wrestling industry. I mean, his run in the late 80s, and he was also a member of the Four Horsemen. In fact, if you ask Ric Flair, Ric Flair has said before, I don't remember if he says this in his book or not, but his favorite iteration of the Four Horsemen was not necessarily the original incarnation, which of course had Flair, J.J. Dillon, Ole Anderson, Arn Anderson, and Tully Blanchard. A lot of people would say that was the best version of the Horseman. And Flair has said before, unless he's changed his tune, his favorite version of the Horseman was him, Barry Windham, Blanchard, and Arn Anderson. And he was a hell of a hand. Hopefully he'll be okay. And certainly a candidate, one would think, for future induction into the WWE Hall of Fame. I guess we'll find out. But hopefully he'll get his health in order. And everything will be okay. He was working behind the scenes at one point for WWE in recent years as a road agent. I don't believe that worked out. I don't remember if he quit, if he was fired. I don't believe he was a road agent for them anymore. And probably for the better. I don't know what led to the heart attack, but it could be a very stressful job working behind the scenes in WWE. So all the best to Barry Windham. Speaking of sad news, just devastating news came yesterday, courtesy of WWE.com, that Maryse has been released from World Wrestling Entertainment. Maryse it set my heart aflutter when I heard this news. She was a person who had no business necessarily being in the ring. She was no better or no worse than any of the other divas you'll see in the ring, like a Kelly Kelly or anybody. I don't want to say Beth Phoenix or Natalya because they actually have some talent in the ring, but Maryse was somebody who should have been a manager. She was so awesome in that role. And, you know, it looked for a while like they may have paired her off with The Miz, and it never actually came to fruition. Of course, she's dating The Miz right now. You know, lucky bastard. But, you know, they put her with Ted DiBiase. That went absolutely nowhere. I don't know whose idea that was. I guess it was their way of trying to get DiBiase over. It failed. It was going to fail anyway. It was destined to do so because they gave him that gimmick. You know, they basically gave him his father's gimmick. He would come out with the $1 million belt. He basically lost. I mean, I remember him losing week after week. How do you expect anybody to get over when you just beat them every week? It's like what they do with Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan was over, and he still has his share of fans. You know, you gave him the Money in the Bank briefcase. He's going to get the championship match at WrestleMania, maybe. But you just beat him week after week after week, and it's their sick, twisted way of trying to get people over. And it just doesn't work, and it didn't work with DiBiase. DiBiase at one point was looked at as a guy who within a couple of years could be headlining WrestleMania. No greater authority than John Cena himself once said that in an interview. He sees himself facing Ted DiBiase within 2 or 3 years in a WrestleMania main event. And that was 2 or 3 years ago. And look where DiBiase is now. He's on Superstars. That says it all. And they put Maryse with him, and he was like a charisma vacuum, just sucked up all the charisma out of Maryse. And all she would do was come out, and she wouldn't even say anything. She would come out with this fancy jewelry on, and they took away everything about her that was appealing. You know, she still was very attractive. But, you know, as a promo, I don't want to say that she was a great promo, but she was very entertaining. She was a great heel character. She could have made a great heel valet for anybody other than Ted DiBiase. She could have managed a headliner. She could have managed a main event guy like The Miz in WWE or somebody like that. And they dropped the ball on her. She hurt herself. She had hernia surgery, I think, several weeks back. She's been out. And as I understand it, this was something that she requested. And WWE gladly granted the release that she wanted. Supposedly, they're not too concerned about her going to TNA. They don't think she will. So I don't know what leads them to believe that. I mean, if I'm TNA, again, not that I want to snatch up every WWE person that gets cut, but you know, there's a lot they could do with somebody like Maryse. Maybe not as a wrestler, but again, put her with Bobby Roode. Put Maryse with Bobby Roode. I mean, come on. I mean, there's a million different things you could do with her. I don't know if she has any interest in going to TNA. I guess we'll find out. And apparently Maryse wasn't too broken up about it. Like I said, it was something that she wanted. She got what she wanted. She went on Twitter. She was posting pictures of her having her release party, which I thought was kind of funny. It was a big cake. It's too bad. It's too bad because she was one of the better female performers on the roster, and it doesn't hurt that she was pretty good eye candy. So, unfortunately, that's one less worthwhile diva they now have, and yet there are other people that they continue to employ, and it just makes me scratch my head why they still remain under contract, and people like Maryse, they gladly let her go. I, for one, will miss those times on Raw when Michael Cole would botch her name and call her Maurice, and Maurice would get on commentary and just absolutely bash him for it. I was always thoroughly entertained by that. Anytime anybody gets on commentary and gives Michael Cole a taste of his own medicine, it's a good thing. There's a few quick words here about Vengeance, which was WWE's big pay-per... I say big pay-per-view. It was a pay-per-view last weekend. And I saw two matches. I saw the main event with John Cena and Alberto Del Rio, last man standing for the WWE Championship. I said last week that this match did nothing for me. Who could possibly care about seeing them? And really, WWE gave us no reason to care. But I will say they had a hell of a match. They really did. I mean, these guys, they went nearly half an hour inside of a broken ring, no less. So kudos to both men. And that's not an easy thing to do. And I don't know, there was one point in the match I really enjoyed. I don't know why. It was they were on the outside, and I think Del Rio had gone. He does this enziguri, which usually when it connects, it makes a great sound. And he went to give Cena, who was up against the steel post on the outside, he went to give him an enziguri, and Cena ducked, and he kind of gave one to the post. I thought that was really cool. Del Rio was going all out in this match, and he won. He retained the championship with a little bit of help from Awesome Truth. And I just thought this match was way above expectations. The Mark Henry Big Show match also exceeded what little expectations I had for it. It's not as though you expect Mark Henry and Big Show to go in there and have a four-star clinic, and they don't have to. I mean, they're two big guys. They go in there, they beat the hell out of each other. I thought the way they did the ring collapse was very well done. As somebody who still remembers Brock Lesnar and the Big Show, and actually they just released the DVD. I think it was on the OMG Top 50 Moments. They just featured, I think, the ring collapse from SmackDown on there. So it was still fresh in the minds of a lot of people, so it comes off as a retread. But then again, it's been, what, 7-8 years since they did it? It was very impressive. The crowd went bonkers for it. I just find it funny, and they did the same thing with Brock and Big Show. If you really look at it, basically it was a superplex from the top rope. It was a slam. And yet both guys are forced to sell it like they're just completely demolished, like a giant building has just collapsed on them, and they can no longer continue. The Big Show has to get carted out, and Mark Henry can barely stand on his own 2 feet. Again, I think the whole thing was very well done, but I just think it's kind of silly, because what really happened to these two guys that would put them out of commission? You know, it would be so horrible they'd have to be carted out by medical officials. It's just kind of stupid to me. But as far as the other matches on the show, I didn't get a chance to see them. Randy Orton, I know, beat Cody Rhodes clean with the RKO. That's not what I would have done. CM Punk and Triple H against Miz and R-Truth, they had what was, by all accounts and hearing from you guys, pretty underwhelming. Not really a great match. Not the match it had to be. And I think Punk took the loss in that match, which is never a good thing. That was Vengeance. There were a couple of other matches. Zack Ryder did not win the U.S. title, as I said he would not. And that led into Raw on Monday night. Basically, all you need to know about Raw is that The Rock is most likely going to be teaming with John Cena at Survivor Series against Miz and R-Truth. Rock is going to be on Raw, I assume, in some sort of tape promo this Monday to officially give his answer as to whether or not he will team with John Cena at the Survivor Series. And perhaps this would be a little more of a mystery to all of us if we didn't already see a bazillion commercials advertising The Rock's in-ring return to Survivor Series. It's that sort of quality control that WWE is usually pretty good with. And I mean, hell, we found out a month or two ago that Rock was going to be back wrestling at Survivor Series. So this all seems rather anticlimactic to me. Cena was so excited on this show to make this announcement that he climaxed all over the microphone. And the other thing on this show, Michael Cole mocked Jim Ross by showing photoshopped pictures of him. The same JR who was already fired on TV, by the way. And he then issued a challenge to JR on Raw for this coming Monday, where if Jim Ross wins, Michael Cole will quit. And Jim Ross can take his seat back on Raw. Those are the big things that happened on this show. Let me get the good out of the way first, because this is really one of those shows where virtually everything on this show falls into the bad or ugly category. This was not a good show. But the one good thing I will say, the Triple H Kevin Nash angle, I thought was done pretty well. You know, but as they do with everything, they went and they overdid it. So I just talked about Mark Henry and the Big Show, right? Superplex off the top, and they had to sell it like they were dead. Stupid. Well, on this show, they do this whole Triple H Kevin Nash angle. And, you know, Kevin Nash comes out, he attacks Triple H from behind with a sledgehammer. Triple H does a pretty damn good job selling it like he's dead, which at least is a little more believable. I mean, if you get hit with a sledgehammer, then yes, it is conceivable that you could be potentially killed. And Triple H is being taken away backstage, loaded up into an ambulance, and Kevin Nash reappears, and he's got the sledgehammer. He chases everybody away. He picks the backboard up with Triple H strapped to it. He stands it up vertical, props it up against a bunch of boxes, and he proceeds to nail Triple H right in the head, right in the face, with the sledgehammer, knocks him down. And Triple H, I guess, is he falls flat on his face on top of everything else. And so the medical personnel, they roll him over, and the first thing they do is they check his pulse. They want to know if Triple H has a pulse. Really now. That's rich. By the way, it looks like CM Punk is not going to get his match with Kevin Nash after all, thus reinforcing the opinion that Kevin Nash is indeed the smartest man in wrestling, because it looks as though they're building to a Triple H Kevin Nash match either at the Survivor Series, maybe at another pay-per-view. Supposedly Triple H suffered a litany of different injuries, potentially even a broken neck. He's going to be out for at least 6 weeks, which of course would mean that he would not be at the Survivor Series. But Triple H, as we know, I mean, the guy got dropped from, what, 50 feet in the air in a car one time and was back the very next week. He's a pretty quick healer. I think he'll be okay. Now let's get to the bad on this show. And there's a lot of it to talk about. John Laryngitis is still very awful on the microphone. You know, at least Mike Adamly was completely clueless in a perversely entertaining sort of way. This guy is just horrible. Just horrible. I mean, I did laugh at his mangling of the WWE Universe slogan.
You need to tell me in front of the WWE Universe.
But that whole segment with Del Rio and CM Punk setting up a potential championship match at Survivor Series, which Laryngitis said he would rule on this coming Monday, by the way, was a complete fail to me, because the crowd just didn't seem to care much about what they were seeing. You know, it seemed to bring Punk down a couple of notches, at least until he laced into Laryngitis about how never has someone done so much with so little, which I thought was a great line. And it's actually one that Laryngitis himself used on his Twitter account a couple of weeks ago in reference to Dusty Rhodes. I think he was wishing Dusty Rhodes a happy birthday, and he used that line. So basically, WWE Creative thought it was good, and they decided to recycle the same line on TV. So, you know, when Punk started showing some real intensity in this segment, it got real good, but it wasn't enough to save it. This just didn't come off as a main event championship feud to me. It just didn't. Wade Barrett and John Morrison had a match. It was okay. It was nothing special. The finish was botched. Morrison came off the ropes. He was supposed to land on Barrett's shoulders. He would then give him wasteland. Unfortunately, Barrett dropped him. And Morrison ended up losing anyway, which you could have figured out without me even telling you that. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Michael Cole issued a challenge to Jim Ross, but not until after showing photoshopped images of him on the Titantron. He was making fun of how fat he is. It's just, be a star, folks. Say no to bullying. Anyway, he said JR had been tweeting insults at him all night. He was fed up. He announced the Michael Cole Challenge for next week in Atlanta, JR's old stomping grounds. He said he wasn't going to announce the rules, and really, how could he? Vince probably scribbled this whole thing down on a napkin 10 minutes before they went on the air. They don't even know what the fucking rules of this thing are going to be yet. And if Ross accepts and he beats Cole, he will quit his job, Colewell, that is, as the lead announcer of Raw, and JR can have his old job back. So, in a way, it's like, wow, that's pretty cool. Maybe Jim Ross, they're going to bring him back. Here's the deal. Let me make this very clear, okay? I know that Jim Ross is going to be there, and he is going to be humiliated in some form or fashion. This is just a guarantee. There could be no other way. In storyline, I wish that he would just refuse to accept and just leave well enough alone. I don't want to see Jim Ross back at the announce booth. It's over. It's quite obvious that Vince McMahon does not want him there. You know, and even if by some chance he was to win this thing on Monday night and actually come back, he's going to make life miserable for the guy. And then for us, by association. Because every time he insults Jim Ross on the air, it's just insufferable to have to sit there and listen to it. So if you're not going to let Jim Ross be Jim Ross, and you're just going to embarrass him every week, then I'd rather not even have him on my TV at all. I'd rather not have Michael Cole either. So here's what I propose. If anyone from WWE is listening, or somebody can get the memo over to them for me, I'd like for you to just turn off all of the announcers' microphones and let the action speak for itself. You've done this a couple of times on Raws over the years. Every now and then, if there's a match involving the announcers, there'll be nobody on commentary. We just hear crowd noise, you know? I don't want any announcing on WWE shows anymore. That's the conclusion I've come to. The shows are much better without any announcing at all. You know, and as confusing as some of their angles tend to be, you know, the announcers never bother explaining them anyway, so why even have them? Why? So they can argue and bicker all the time? So they can talk about who's trending on Twitter? No, thank you. And speaking of Twitter, that leads me to the ugly. Two very big ugly things. First of all, I have to say this. The Twitter thing is out of control. Just out of fucking control. Every week, he's trending on Twitter. We're trending on Twitter. Be sure to go hashtag Raw. Hey, you want to put hashtag Raw on the screen at the beginning of the show and tell people that if you want to tweet during the show, put the hashtag there? That's fine. I get that. Everybody does that now. But they take everything to the extreme. They take something that is okay, and they blow it up into something that just makes you want to blow your brains out. Every fucking 5 minutes on this show, it's something about Twitter. Twitter this, Twitter that. They'll give you the did you know fact. Did you know that this person has more Twitter followers than this? And John Cena has more Twitter followers than Gandhi. And this and that. And it's just, it's out of control. They've just absolutely gone off the rails. And they've taken this to a point where I just can't take it anymore. It's just, and it's only going to get worse. Apparently they have bigger plans for the Twitter stuff. It's going to continue for the next couple of months. And, I can't handle it. I don't know about you, but I cannot deal with this every single week. It is just beyond the point of no return with this Twitter stuff. They just come off as so lame. Every time they talk about the fact that we were trending on Twitter, wow, Zack Ryder was in a segment last week and he was trending on Twitter. Santino came out for the first match in like 6 months and he was trending on Twitter. Who gives a shit? Who cares who's trending on Twitter? What difference does it make? Is it making you money? Is it bringing new people in? No! People are going to look on Twitter, they're going to see the top trending terms, and they're going to see Sheamus, and they're going to be, what the fuck is a Sheamus? They're not going to know. I don't see what the appeal is in this, you know? I really don't. I don't see why we need to know who's trending on Twitter every single week. Do they do this in other sports like the NHL or the NBA? I guess the NBA is a bad example, but let's take the NFL, for example, okay? I watch a little bit of football, but not too much. Are there any local announcers for any of the football teams out there where you people are that talk about this sort of thing, or even the announcers on Fox, Joe Buck and all that? Do they talk about who's trending on Twitter, which player is trending on Twitter, which team is trending on Twitter? I'm willing to bet all the money in the world that they don't do that. And there's a reason for that. But WWE, they have to talk about all their guys trending on Twitter. See, they're trending on Twitter. That means they're important. That means they're special. That means they're pop culture. They're back in the mainstream. Bullshit. Doesn't mean that at all. The other ugly thing on this show was John Cena losing control of his bodily functions at the very end. That was pretty damn ugly. Hilariously enough, I happened to be up last night when AM Raw was on USA. AM Raw is basically a one-hour recap version of Raw that goes on at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And when you're sick and you're hopped up on all the medication like I am, cough medicine and all that kind of stuff, you kind of flip channels, and I happen to come across AM Raw, and I'm watching at the very end, and they have seen his big announcement where he announces that The Rock is the person that he has chosen to be his tag team partner against Miz and Truth at the Survivor Series, and they edited the part out where he exploded all over the microphone, which is great. I'm happy they did, but just thought that was kind of funny. Now, as far as Survivor Series is concerned, originally the belief was that it was going to be a 5-on-5 Survivor Series match. And I see certain people saying, well, you know, you reported it was going to be a 5-on-5 match, and you don't know what you're talking about. I could have sworn that when that poster was released, I don't remember if it was written on the poster or if it was in some sort of promotional tagline that accompanied the poster, which was officially released by WWE. I could have sworn there was a very specific mention about it being a 5-on-5 Survivor Series-style match. Maybe I'm just imagining things, and I'm just assuming that we all assumed it would be. But I thought there was a pretty clear indication that that's what it was going to be. And I have no doubt in my mind that that was the original plan. I really do believe that. And obviously that plan has changed. Now, Would I rather see a Survivor Series match rather than a tag match? Honestly, I would. But that's just me. I was always a fan of the elimination matches, and I thought it would be a pretty clever way to, you know, get The Rock in there, but not get him in there where he's wrestling too much. You don't want to give too much of him away in this match. You want to save that for WrestleMania. As far as Miz and R-Truth are concerned, is there anybody listening to this show that actually thinks Miz and R-Truth have a prayer? I mean, if you put the team of John Cena and The Rock, John Cena, Super Cena, who barely ever loses, okay, you put him in any match, and 85% of the time he's going to win. You put him and The Rock together as a tag team, does Miz and R-Truth really come off as much of a threat? I'm not even saying Miz and Truth won't win. In fact, I think there's a pretty damn good chance that they'll win. Because if they did this match right, they would build the heat between Cena and Rock even more and maybe have one guy cost the other guy the match. Or the fact that maybe they don't get along, one guy inadvertently cost the other guy the match. There's no reason for them to win. I mean, you want to give the fans in the Garden, of which I'll be part of that crowd that night, you want to give the people a feel-good moment at the end of the show. But Miz and R-Truth, I know they've been trying very hard to build them up as being some sort of really dangerous threat. I don't know that I'm ever going to look at The Miz quite like that, but I will say they've been trying. They've been trying very hard. I don't see them as really that much of a threat. It's the best thing they've got right now. They don't have anybody better, I guess, to put in that role as much of a threat against the two of them, but I don't know. I really think that they should have gone with a 5-on-5 Survivor Series match. I mean, you could have condensed a couple of different matches into one. You could have had Rock and Cena team up, for example, with Triple H, CM Punk, and maybe round it out with Sheamus and put them in there against Alberto Del Rio, Christian, Kevin Nash, Miz, and R-Truth. And that could have been your 5-on-5 match. You could still put Randy Orton in there with somebody. Or, you know, even in that match, if you wanted to put Orton in there instead of Sheamus and Christian, put Orton in there on the babyface side and put Cody Rhodes on the heel side. You still have enough other guys where you can have other matches. You can have a rematch with Mark Henry and The Big Show. You can have another Survivor Series match. So that's probably how I would have done it. But I guess we'll find out this Monday night what Rock's response is to John Cena. I don't want to see the two of them as friends. You know, to see the two of them as friends, to me, would kill the WrestleMania match. And it's bad enough they had the two of them shake hands the way they did on Raw right after WrestleMania this year. They should never have even done that. I want to take a little bit of time here to review the new Shawn Michaels vs. Bret Hart Rivalries DVD. I know a lot of you have already seen it. A lot of you want to see it. For those of you who have not picked up a copy, I would advise you to go do so right now. In fact, pause this show and go order it, because it's one of the better WWE DVDs that the company has ever released. And it's the first DVD of theirs I've purchased in quite a long time, and it's a purchase I don't regret. This stuff is great. I'm not even completely through all three discs. It's a three-disc DVD. I do not have the Blu-ray version. The Blu-ray version has some additional extras, including the full Montreal match from Survivor Series in 1997. And I watched the documentary portion, which clocks in, I didn't time it, I think it's about 2 hours or so. And I've gone through most of the matches, not all of them, on disc two. So let me talk about the documentary first. Basically, the way this thing is structured here, it is, for all intents and purposes, if you really want to look at it like this, it is the first ever WWE shoot interview that the company has released. And, you know, they want to release more of these. Supposedly, Steve Austin and The Rock are on tap as being the next release in the series. I think that could be very interesting. There's actually a bunch of different combinations that they could put together that would be very interesting. You know, Triple H and Mick Foley, and I don't know if they would want to bring some legends in there, but here are two guys who started in the business as friends, became bitter enemies, didn't speak with each other for years and years and years, and finally were able to reconcile. And have become, by all accounts, they've become legitimate friends. They keep in touch. They text one another. It's really quite an interesting story. And there's a lot of material on here that spans their days starting out as tag teams, the Rockers, the Hart Foundation, and WWF together. Basically, the way the DVD is structured, Jim Ross sits down and interviews both men who are sitting beside one another. And they give you a quick synopsis of each man's career at the very beginning. And then they start from the tag team days. And they talk about, as I said, the Hart Foundation. They talk about the Rockers. They talk about working with each other. They talk a lot. And Shawn Michaels, in particular, seems very animated when he talks about the fact that when Sean had worked in other territories, when he was in the AWA and he was in other places, his size, you know, relatively speaking, Shawn Michaels was a small wrestler. He was about 6 feet tall, maybe around 200 pounds, maybe a little bit more than that. By the standards, especially back then when you had all these big 300-pound dudes, he was a small guy. But it was never an issue for him wherever he worked because people would look at that and say, wow, you know, I could work with this small guy. He'll bump all over the place for me. You know, I want to work with somebody like that. And when he came to WWF, all of that changed. You know, because Vince McMahon's mentality was bigger is better. And the WWF back in the mid to late 80s was filled with, well, it was filled with steroid monsters. It was filled with people like The Warlord. And it was filled with people like Hulk Hogan and you know, some of the other people they had, The Barbarian. And I mean, you could just run the whole list of people. Probably 90% of the people in that company were on steroids at the time. And Sean found this to be incredibly frustrating. I mean, his emotions, his anger really comes through at different points here in this interview. Because now he comes to the big time, and all of a sudden people don't want to work with him because he's too small. And this bothered him. You could tell that it bothered him a great deal, probably even more so than Bret Hart. But in spite of that, the two teams, they worked their asses off. They worked against each other quite a few times. And they basically just busted their ass to work their way up and prove to management that they were the workhorses of the company. You know, that when they would have house shows, for example, back then, it was not uncommon to have your main event, let's say it was Hulk Hogan defending the WWF Championship against somebody, go on in the middle of the show just prior to intermission. And to have a tag team match as the main event at the very end of the show that would go 20, 30, 40 minutes. And oftentimes that was the spot that the Rockers would find themselves in, or the Hart Foundation would find themselves in. And I think it was Sean on the DVD who joked, the main event guys like Hogan and all of them could actually catch room service, because by the time the show was over, and if, let's say, the tag teams went on last, went back to the hotel, there's no room service beyond a certain time. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So that's how the DVD starts, and talks about their tag team background. Works its way up, of course, to when both men began branching out as single stars. Shawn Michaels as the boy toy, managed by Sherry. Bret Hart, of course, his big moment came at SummerSlam in 91 when he beat Kurt Hennig to become the Intercontinental Champion. And it was interesting because Jim Ross asked Shawn Michaels, you know, did you view Bret winning the Intercontinental title as some sort of barrier that had been broken? Was it in a way a situation where Bret was kind of like the flag bearer? When he won that belt, it was proof that the smaller guys could kind of be somebody in WWF. And Shawn's response to that was no. He didn't look at it that way at all, because Bret had won the Intercontinental title. And it wasn't the same as winning the WWF Championship. You know, to Sean, and he's absolutely correct in this view, the Intercontinental title was the title for the workhorse back then. And, you know, if you were a good worker and a great, technically sound wrestler, the Intercontinental Championship was always the title for you. You know, Ricky Steamboat held that title. Randy Savage, before he became the world champion, held that title. Kurt Hennig held that title. Rick Rude. Now Bret Hart. And Sean said, you know, he didn't really look at it like that, because he would have expected somebody like Bret to win the championship at some point, but he never would have expected Bret, for example, to beat Flair and win the WWF title. And when that happened, that's a different story. That opened a lot of eyes to a lot of people in that company. They talked about how Bret and Sean around this time became good friends. Bret talked about Sean would come over to his house and hang out with his kids. I mean, that's how close these two guys were. And it's interesting, if you follow their careers, how closely they mimicked each other. Because, again, they both started out as a tag team. Right? They were tag team wrestlers in WWF. And back then, who would have expected that one half of the Hart Foundation would go on to become one of the greatest champions in company history? Who would have expected that one half of the Rockers, great tag team, but I don't know that anybody ever looked at them as being mid-card at best, that one half of that team would go on to become a Hall of Famer? Nobody would have expected that. I mean, there were people in the company who saw the work that Shawn Michaels did and the work that Bret Hart did, but as a fan back then, the way that we were trained and conditioned to look at these guys, nobody ever would have expected anything like that. And yet both guys obviously went on to have very successful singles careers. Both guys went on to become Hall of Famers. And when they first became single stars, again, Bret won the Intercontinental Championship. Shawn eventually won the Intercontinental Championship. Bret won the WWF title. And it's amazing to me to look back at the Survivor Series in 1992. because that show, and I'll get to that match in a second because that's one of the bonus matches on Disc 2. Survivor Series 92 is a show that was completely overhauled from what the original card was supposed to be. The original main event of that pay-per-view was supposed to be the team of Ultimate Warrior and Randy Savage against Ric Flair and Razor Ramon. And Bret Hart, and I remember this because I still have somewhere the old copy of the WWF magazine at the time, which had a preview of all the Survivor Series matches. Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels was supposed to be an undercard match, no championships on the line, just one-on-one, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. Bulldog, British Bulldog, who had beaten Bret a couple months earlier at Wembley to become the Intercontinental Champion, was supposed to defend the title on that show against the Mountie. So look at that whole card and think about what ended up happening. Ultimate Warrior got fired. British Bulldog got fired. Drugs, that's why. So all of a sudden, the tag match became Randy Savage and Mr. Perfect, who had not been wrestling at the time, who had been a heel. He had to do a very quick babyface turn, come back to wrestle. He teamed with Savage against Flair and Ramon in the middle of the show. The main event of that show became Bret Hart defending the WWF Championship against Shawn Michaels, who had just beaten Bulldog for the Intercontinental title about a month earlier. So it was champion against champion for the WWF belt in the main event. This is 1992, WWF. They started cracking down on steroids and all that, but I look back on that era, that's still the era of the big man. That's the era of Flair, who wasn't, you know, as big as some of these other guys, but, you know, the main event, the usual guys, Flair, Hogan, Sid, Savage, Undertaker, you know, those types of guys. And here's the Survivor Series, pay-per-view. Bret Hart is the champion, and he is defending in the main event against Shawn Michaels. That's pretty damned impressive right there. And as if that wasn't eerie enough to have a Bret vs. Shawn WWF title match in the main event at a Survivor Series 5 years before Montreal, guess who the referee was for that match? In fact, guess who the referee was for the what I believe was the very first Bret vs. Shawn singles match on television in WWF back in 1990 on Wrestling Challenge? It was Earl Hebner. Earl Hebner seemed to be, he came as like a package deal, I guess, with these guys. Every match that I can remember Bret and Shawn ever having, I think Earl Hebner was the referee, including the Iron Man match at WrestleMania. So that's kind of funny. So anyway, you know, the documentary goes on. It really gets into the juicy stuff. And there were a couple things that did jump out at me I wanted to mention here. Just fast-forwarding a little bit to 96-97. And there's a very weird part of this documentary where Bret is talking about Shawn Michaels, who, when Shawn Michaels first became the big babyface star in 96, I guess 95 into 96, he used to do this thing where he would invite little kids into the ring to dance with him. Could be a little boy, girl, didn't matter. And it was, you know, it's what babyfaces would do, only this was Shawn's act. He would invite the kid into the ring, and he would do a little bit of a dance with them, no big deal. And Bret talked about not liking that because Shawn would have kids, and this is according to Bret, come into the ring and do little strip teases in the ring with him, pulling their pants down a bit to their pube line. What? I couldn't believe. When I heard that, I actually had a fast, I had to rewind it. I couldn't believe what I had just heard. And the funniest part about this whole thing was Shawn Michaels, who was being very deferential, I think, for part of this interview. There were certain things. Bret's got a very good memory, especially for somebody who went through a stroke and went through the health issues that he did. He's got a pretty damn good memory, and there were parts where Shawn was like, you know, I don't remember that, but if Bret says it happened or if Bret says I said that, then it must be true. It must have happened. And at this part, Shawn just looks at Bret and goes, what? I don't remember this. And then he kind of looks at the camera as Bret continues to talk. Shawn turns the other way, looks into the camera, and makes this face like he could not believe what he was hearing. And I couldn't believe it either. I remember when Shawn used to do this, and, you know, Shawn had his little dance that he would do and all that, but I never looked at it as being a striptease, nor do I recall at any point any kids pulling their pants down to their pube line. That's just creepy. I mean, that is just creepy to even include that on the DVD. So I thought that was rather eye-opening. There was another interesting part here. Bret was talking about, and we're already in 1997 at this point, and he put a little line in there about how the plan was for him to go to WrestleMania 14 in 1998 and drop the title there to Shawn Michaels. And this seemed to come as news to Shawn as it did to me. I had never heard that before. You know, this is they're probably talking about Montreal already at this point, and the different scenarios where Brett had no problem dropping the title. He just did not want to lose to Sean in Montreal because of the infamous conversation where Brett went up to Sean a couple weeks before the pay-per-view, and they were trying to work out their issues, and Brett actually went to Sean backstage and said, listen, you know, I just want you to know that I'm willing to do business the right way. I'm willing to lose the championship to you and whatever. And Sean's response to that was, I appreciate that, but I just want you to know that I'm not willing to do the same. And Brett talks about the fact there were people there who witnessed the whole thing. Jim Neidhart was there. Ken Shamrock was there. I think there were some other wrestlers as well who were there, who were within earshot when Sean said this. And there were other wrestlers who over time have claimed that, take it one step further. Sean didn't just say he wouldn't lose to Brett. Sean basically said he's not losing to anybody. Just like his gimmick on TV, he would lay down for nobody. There were wrestlers who were livid at Shawn Michaels. They wanted to tear him limb from limb for saying something like that. That one line is what set Brett off, and basically, I don't want to say that it led to the screw job. There were a lot of things that led to the screw job. Triple H, for example, I'll get to him in a second, was a very instrumental part of Brett being screwed at the pay-per-view. But that one line, Brett could not believe that Sean had disrespected him that way. And at that point, and it's hard to argue, Brett said, I'm not willing to lose to this guy. This guy's got no respect for me. I was the bigger man. I went to him. He turns around to me and says, I'm not willing to lose to you? And it just kind of snowballed from there. And, you know, I could see where in 2011, this is all kind of silly. I mean, think about the way things are today and how serious everything was taken back then. The championship actually meant something. It's actually kind of sad to look back on this, because it really is an era that we're never going to have ever again. But back then, this stuff meant something to these people. These people were passionate about their craft, and the championship did mean something at that point. And anyway, there were a lot of different things that led to Montreal. But the thing about Brett, you know, when he said, you know, at one point the plan was for me and Sean to go to Mania, and the only thing that would have made sense was that it would have been Mania 14, because based on the timeline, I know that at one point, and they even talk about this, Brett versus Sean were supposed to have their big rematch from the Iron Man match. It was supposed to be at WrestleMania 13. They were supposed to wait a year, do the match, Brett would go over. Sean, of course, won the championship from Sid, then he lost his smile, supposedly suffered a knee injury, and forfeited the title on TV. And Brett pulls no punches on here. He even says, with Sean sitting right next to him, he didn't buy the injury then, he doesn't buy it now. He thinks Sean was bullshitting. He never suffered a knee injury. Sean maintains, for whatever it's worth, he did have a knee injury. It just turns out that the doctor he went to told him his career was over, he had to retire, and later on, when he had the same knee checked out by Dr. Jim Andrews, who of course is a world-renowned specialist, Andrews said, yeah, your knee is fucked up, but it's not fucked up to the point where you can't wrestle. So that's why Sean came back. And when Sean came back, he was showing no ill effects of having a knee injury. I don't buy that Sean ever had an injury either. I kind of side with Brett on that, but we'll never know for sure. But I had never heard that the plan for WrestleMania 14 was to do Brett versus Sean. I mean, imagine if that would have happened. How the course of history might have changed. Even WrestleMania 13, if they would have done Brett versus Sean at that show, Steve Austin is left out in the cold. Steve Austin doesn't go on to have that monumental career-defining match with Bret Hart in Chicago. How does that potentially change the course of WWE history? I'm fascinated by these sorts of things, because it's a total what-if question. You know, you never know for sure. You like to think that Steve Austin was a talented enough guy. The cream always rises to the top. He would have been a big star no matter what. But how big? Would he have been as big as he was? That match was pretty important in the evolution of the Steve Austin character in WWE. In a way, I kind of think that things worked out for the better in that respect. So then they talk about Montreal, and I don't want to get too much into it, but the one thing I was happy to hear on this thing was verification of what had been reported by certain journalists like Dave Meltzer from the very beginning. And there were people over time who still doubted the legitimacy of these claims, and I hope those people now can just shut the fuck up. Triple H had as much of a hand in this screw job as anybody. There was a conversation, there was a conference call, involving Shawn Michaels, Vince McMahon, Triple H, who was, I believe it was a meeting, and Triple H may have been on the phone. And there may have been one other person in the meeting. It was basically just those people, though. And this would have been probably within a week or so, the week before the pay-per-view. Brett obviously was not willing to drop the title to Shawn. He just, Vince, no matter what he tried to say or do to convince Brett, could not convince Brett, and they had a problem. They didn't know what to do. And Shawn, you know, his approach was, well, you know, I'll do whatever you want. And there was a point in the conversation where there was a very awkward pause, and Triple H, on the line, decides to pipe up. And this is when Vince, I think, just went ahead and proposed that they just do some sort of schmoz, like a DQ or something. And Triple H pipes up on the phone and says, fuck that. And this is what Shawn said. Shawn said Triple H basically was the person who piped up and said, F that. If this guy is not going to do business the right way, then we're going to have to do business for him. And of course, Vince likes to play coy and says, well, you know, does this mean what I think it means? Or something like that. It really did. They talk about the fact that this whole thing sounded like a mob hit. And Shawn Michaels compares himself, a very weird comparison, but he compares himself on the DVD to Sammy the Bull Gravano, who was a former mafioso, bumped off a lot of people in his time. And it really was. I mean, it was like a mob hit, you know, from this conspiracy that was going on at the time. And Vince apparently didn't want to come right out and say, let's screw him. So he let Triple H be the one to actually say it without actually saying it, because, again, Triple H never said the word screw job. He just said, well, fuck that. We have to do what we have to do. And then I like the whole idea that Vince was playing very coy and was like, well, you know, I have to think about this, what you're proposing here. And, of course, it went from there. You know, the plan was put into effect. Shawn knew about it. He denied it at first, but... I think the first time he came clean was probably the that old WWF Confidential show. And they had Shawn on. This was many years ago, probably like 2002. And he admitted that he knew. He had to have known. You know, Gerald Briscoe offered to teach him some submission holds and moves to defend himself in the hotel the night before in case, you know, things got a little fuzzy in there, got a little hairy with Brett. You know, the sharpshooter was really the pivotal point of that match. You couldn't have a fast count, because if you had a fast count, even if it worked, Brett's going to know at that point that Shawn knew, and Shawn fucked him. And Brett, I mean, could you imagine if Bret Hart, after getting screwed, just grabbed Shawn Michaels in the middle of the ring in front of the world on pay-per-view and beat the piss out of the WWE champion and then went to WCW? That would have been really, really bad. So to protect Shawn, they needed that submission. They needed the sharpshooter. They needed a reason for Shawn to go, well, I didn't know. You know, Vince called for the bell. I knew nothing about this. So anyway, the Montreal stuff, you know, you've heard it once, you've heard it a million times, but seeing these two guys sit side by side together going over the whole thing and Jim Ross kind of needling them with questions, wanting more and more in the way of details, it really is fascinating stuff. Even if you're sick of hearing about Montreal, and hopefully this is the last of it. This will hopefully put this shit to bed once and for all. It still is easily the most fascinating part of the entire DVD. And I would, again, highly recommend that you pick up a copy and check it out, because it's just really interesting stuff. And then, of course, they talk about some of the bad luck that befell Bret Hart subsequent to his leaving WWE. WCW never used him to his full potential. Owen, of course, died in that accident. In Kansas City, Brett suffered the concussion, the mule kick from Goldberg that ended his career. Then he suffered the stroke. He talked about what happened when he was on his bike that day when he suffered his stroke. Vince McMahon was the first person to call him and all that. The one thing that strikes me about Brett, and I tend to side with him a lot, you know, when he talks about all this stuff on the DVD, he's a very sympathetic character. I think for the most part, he's very honest. Brett does take his lumps on here. He does admit when things got really, really rough between him and Shawn in that 96-97 period that he probably said certain things to instigate Shawn that he should not have said, and he takes responsibility for that. You know, the plan was the two of them wanted to work everybody. He wanted them to work the fans, work the boys into thinking that there was some legitimate heat between him and Shawn. Brett said at the end of the day it was all about making money. If they thought me and Shawn really hated each other, then that was great. And what ended up happening was, you know, Brett would go on TV and make these comments about Shawn posing for girly magazines and suggesting maybe that he was gay and all this other stuff. And it really got to Shawn. And then Shawn decided, well, you know what, I'm going to go on TV and say stuff about Brett. And I'm going to insult his parents and say that Stu Hart, you know, he's walking around. He doesn't know that he's dead yet. And, of course, the Sunny Days comment, which is infamous, where Shawn basically was insinuating some sort of relationship between Bret Hart and Sonny. There was never any evidence of that. That comment on Raw happened to come 1 week after Brett kind of screwed Shawn over in a way. Brett was in a wheelchair recovering from knee surgery, and he invited Shawn to come out to the ring. And I remember this, too. You can find it on YouTube. Brett is sitting in the wheelchair, cutting one of the worst promos I've ever heard him cut. He is just stuttering and stammering over his words, repeating himself over and over and over again, just talking about how Shawn Michaels is scum, he's this, he's that. And the plan was that Brett would stand up at the end of the segment, Shawn would super kick him in the face, knock him over his wheelchair, and that's how Raw would go off the air. And instead, Brett just kept talking and talking and talking to the point where they had to go off the air. And they actually went off the air in the middle of Brett insulting Shawn. Shawn never got his kick in on TV. He got to kick Brett, but they were already off the air at that point. They didn't get to show that footage on TV until the following week. Shawn didn't know about this until he walked through the curtain. And he wanted to know how, you know, what'd you think of the segment and everything? And they said, well, you didn't get your kick in. And he was livid. He was beside himself. Shawn said that he cut a promo on anybody and everybody backstage when that happened. And it was little things like that that really led to this bad blood boiling over between the two of them. And it really is a shame. It really does come across as one giant misunderstanding. And if these two guys would have just gotten together and really hashed it out early on, all of this could have been avoided. But you know what? How would that have changed the course of history? Again, if Montreal does not happen the way it does, Vince McMahon does not get over as the evil Mr. McMahon character the way that he was able to, which means there's no Austin versus McMahon feud, at least maybe not as successful as it was. And that really was what carried WWF through the late 90s. I mean, that's what led to the company just surging ahead of WCW and ultimately led to the demise of WCW, that among other things. So it's just a fascinating look back at history. If you're not familiar with Brett and Shawn and their whole feud, if you're too young or if you weren't a wrestling fan back then, and you're probably thinking to yourself, what's the big deal? You know, these two guys are arguing over who's going to win the title. It just seems so silly. Again, it is kind of silly looking back on it. But back then, these guys took what they did very, very seriously. It's not like John Cena going out there as the corporate kiss-ass. He'll say anything. He'll do anything. You know, to him, it's a job. How much passion does he really have for it? I don't want to question, you know, John Cena's passion or anything like that. But I look at the current crop of wrestlers out there, and they're very talented, and they work very hard. But I just think back then it was a completely different class of people. You know, those guys came up in the business a completely different way, and it's just a different world now. You know, wrestling is not what it used to be. It's never going to be that way ever again. And if you want one last real dose of the way things used to be, this DVD is for you. I really cannot recommend it enough. And as far as the extras that I've gone through so far on the second disc, I've gone through most of them, not all of them. There's a Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels match from Wrestling Challenge in 1990. It's a pretty good match for what it is. It ends basically, I think, on a double DQ or something where Jim Neidhart gets involved, Marty Jannetty gets involved. Again, they were both part of their respective tag teams back then. But again, kind of interesting to see Earl Hebner as the referee in that match. There's a Rocker's Heart Foundation match from the Tokyo Dome back in 1991. This is when WWE had a working agreement going on with the SWS promotion over in Japan. And this was part of the WrestleFest show in 91. And miraculously, I should mention this, there's two things on this DVD, at least on disc two, that really shocked me, but I was very happy with. The first thing is that WWE, what they're doing now with their DVDs and with the stuff on Classics on Demand, I don't know what the right word is. Perhaps if there's somebody listening out there who knows a little bit about this sort of thing, they can tell me what the terminology is. Maybe Bill Mitchell or somebody who's listening. If you watch an old match in its original form, okay, let's say from Raw back in the day or something, and if they take that footage, and I guess if they digitize it, maybe that's the right word, it almost looks like it was filmed now. You know, they're digitizing all of their footage, and you could tell there's a difference in the way the footage looks now as compared to the way it looks in its original format. I preferred the footage in its original format, looking like it was just recorded off a camera as opposed to digitized and looking like a film. And WWE is digitizing all of their footage now. But on this DVD, the matches on disc 2 are in their original form. They don't look filmed or anything like that. They look the way they should look, and I thought that was really cool. I actually like that a lot, and I don't know if it makes a difference. The version I bought is not the Blu-ray version. I don't have HD. Maybe the Blu-ray version, everything is digitized, but on the regular version, it isn't, and I think it looks a lot better that way. The other thing was, in this Tokyo Dome match from 91, they kept the original Japanese commentary in there. There is no American commentary. Now, part of me thought it would have been kind of cool to have some sort of alternate track with Brett and Sean in studio kind of talking about the match, but I watched this match, you know, with the Japanese commentary, and I thought it was fine. It was a long match. It was a pretty good match. I could see where some people would watch it and think, wow, the crowd's not into this match. But, you know, you got to expect that this match was one of probably like a dozen or more matches on this card. And the Japanese crowds react differently than they do in the States. They're generally more respectful. They're generally more reserved. And they pop for, you know, the bigger moments in the match. So I could see where it might come off as a little flat. The match itself I thought was really, really good. And I believe the Hart Foundation won. And the one thing I commented on Twitter about after I watched this match was I watched it with the Japanese commentary, and even with the Japanese commentary, I didn't understand a goddamn thing they were saying. It was still 10 times better than any match with American commentary on WWE television today. I would gladly watch Raw with Japanese commentary every week than have to sit there and suffer through Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler and Booker T. And I'm not even joking. I'm not saying that to be funny. I actually mean that. Like, I'm watching this match. I don't understand a word they're saying. And even so, it comes off as more professional. It still comes off as an important match to me. There's no announcer talking about how Marty Jannetty is boring. And, you know, after this match is over, I'm going to go show fat pictures of Gorilla Monsoon. And all the bickering and the banter and the bullshit back and forth. And Booker T speaking whatever language it is that he speaks. It's just, it's like night and day. Night and day. So I actually enjoyed the hell out of that match. There's also a ladder match for the Intercontinental Championship. I've seen this match a whole bunch of times, and I actually have a copy of the original Coliseum video. It's called Smack 'em Whack 'em. This match was, I don't believe, ever aired on television. It was recorded at a WWE, one of those marathon TV tapings they used to have back then. And it was the very first official ladder match ever in WWE. It was an idea that Brett, I believe, brought to Vince McMahon. They had done some ladder matches in the old Stampede days. And Vince said, well, let me see what it looks like. And at this taping, they had a ladder match between Brett and Shawn. It was for the Intercontinental title. And it was a hell of a match. You know, even you watch this match, if you're a newer fan, a younger fan, you try to compare it to the ladder matches of today, it probably will come off as underwhelming. Because in ladder matches today, I mean, the stuff they do to each other is just ridiculous. You compare it to a TLC match, and this match will come off as boring. But on its own, it's a pretty damn good match. I mean, I really thought that they did a hell of a job in there. And again, these are two guys. Shawn Michaels had never been in a ladder match before this. And I doubt they had much in the way of, you know, time to really practice and rehearse. And you know, it was interesting watching the crowd react, because I'm sure in most cases, this is the first time the crowd had probably seen a ladder match as well. But definitely a really, really good match, and worth going out of your way to see. The commentary was Gorilla Monsoon and Lord Alfred Hayes. And Lord Alfred Hayes, God bless him, he could be pretty awful. I mean, he could be 6 different ways to awful. But I thought in this match he was pretty good, actually, and Monsoon was pretty good. And, you know, there was one part of the match where they start using the ladder as a weapon. And, you know, I think Lord Alfred Hayes was talking about how, well, that ladder is bringing bad luck to people. And Monsoon piped up and said, well, that ladder is going to bring some good luck to somebody at the end of the match. I thought that was a very good point for him to make. And good stuff here. There was also an Intercontinental Championship match from Syracuse, New York in 92 between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. I had one person email me saying that WWE made a mistake because they list the date on that match as being from April of 1992, and yet Jim Ross is on commentary with Gorilla Monsoon. And in fact, it was not an error. This match was taped just a couple of weeks after WrestleMania 8. And yes, Jim Ross did not come into the company for another 11 months. But what they would routinely do at these Coliseum video releases back then was they would have, let's say, Jim Ross in 93 go into studio and do announcing on a match that was taped in the summer or the fall of 92. There were plenty of matches that Jim Ross did commentary for that had Ric Flair in them, for example. And Flair was already gone from WWE by the time Jim Ross came in. That's just what they did back then. So the date was not wrong. And this was also a pretty good match. It ended a little anticlimactically. It was a countout. And somewhat surprising, when the match was over, Sean, of course, did the whole thing where he thought he won the championship, and then, you know, Howard Finkel makes the announcement the title can only change hands on a pinfall or a submission. Sean punches the referee in the face, and Brett came in. They brawled for another 30 seconds or so. This was kind of hot, actually, at the very end there. The crowd was really into it. You know, I don't think I've ever seen a bad Bret Hart-Shawn Michaels match. You know, even back then, some of the matches were better than others, but they just had a chemistry in there that very few people have. And the last match I saw, I haven't watched the cage match that's on here, but I did watch the Survivor Series 1992 match. A very long match, a little slow in spots, way too many chin locks and rest holds by Shawn Michaels. Those moves don't have any place in wrestling anymore. They really don't. I mean, you're watching, let's say, Bret Hart put an armbar on Shawn Michaels, and I look at this and I just say to myself, why is that supposed to hurt him? You know, it's like, do we really need these holds in this match? It really picked up at the end. Of course, Bret Hart got the win, and the irony is not lost on me that 5 years before Montreal, we had a WWE Championship main event match with Bret Hart defending the title against Shawn Michaels with Earl Hebner as the guest referee. And there you go. So that's all I've watched so far. Again, I haven't watched all the matches on disc two. The third disc has the complete Iron Man match, as well as each man's Hall of Fame induction. And if you have a chance to buy the DVD, pick it up. You know, it's worth it. I mean, if ever there was a DVD that was worth plunking down $20 or $25 on, it's this one. It's just completely fascinating. You're getting a tremendous discussion and a debate between the two people, and you get on top of that a bunch of great matches. Just a bunch of great matches, and the Hall of Fame inductions on top of that. So highly, highly recommend it. Two thumbs up. Check it out. I'm also going to be checking out Memphis Heat. I've heard some of you say great things about it and have asked me if I'm going to review that. I have a copy of it. I have not had a chance to watch it yet. I'm hoping that either next week or maybe the week after I'll have a chance to really sit down and watch it. I think it's about 90 minutes or so. And once I do that, I will be sure to have a review right here on the Sound Off. With that out of the way, it's time for a monster-size Halloween mailbag. First, I want to give a shout-out to all the ghouls and goblins that follow the Sound Off each and every week who took the time to leave a review on iTunes. I'd asked you kindly to do so. Go rate the show and leave a little bit of a review. And many of you did that. I said that if you did, I would give you a shout-out by name on the show. By the way, that still applies. So if you have not yet left a review or any sort of feedback on the Sound Off, not necessarily any particular episode, just the show in general, you could find the show on iTunes, Solomonster Sounds Off, leave a review, give us a star rating. I would really appreciate it. If you do, email me or hit me up on Facebook, let me know, and I will give you a shout-out on the show. So shout-outs this week go out to Rory Bennett, AJ Grimaldo, Paul Sutcliffe, Ruben Nichols, Marcus Naredo, Brian Collins, Andrew Phillips, Brad Yike, Tane Stevenson, Jonathan Edwards, and quite simply, the Crabapple Kid, if that is your real name. Those are the shout-outs for this week. If I missed you, it is possible I missed you because I checked iTunes a little earlier, and I only got the names of the people who were in iTunes when I last checked. It may not be fully refreshed yet, so do not fear. Email me and let me know, and if I missed you or if you leave feedback in the future, I'll be sure to mention you on an upcoming show. But if you would do that, I would be very much indebted to you. All right, time for questions. Ryan Lacey writes in, "Dear Solomonster, something that no one seems to realize with respect to Big Show and Mark Henry, including WWE, Big Show got drafted to Raw from SmackDown. So if he were to win, let's say, which of course he didn't, this question came in before Vengeance, wouldn't both titles be on Raw? Or did WWE just say, screw that, and we are just going to hope that people are stupid enough to forget like they always do?" Yeah, that's pretty much what they did. See, your mistake is that you're talking about this brand extension, this brand split, as though it actually means something. And if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, then you know full well that it actually means less than nothing. Mike from Mount Sterling, Kentucky writes in, "What happened to Kurt Angle? He is half the size he was in WWE. Is he sick?" This comes from Mike. Kurt is sick, actually. Sick in the head. No, he lost a lot of weight, supposedly for movie roles and such, and now he is supposedly training for the Olympics, although he's fucked up his hamstring, so I'm not quite sure how much training he can do. But yeah, if you look at Kurt Angle in WWE, you look at Kurt Angle in TNA, it is a, a stark difference in physique. I'll leave that up to you to figure out exactly why that is. Let's just say that in that regard, Kurt is actually a lot healthier than he was in WWE. Mohsin from Pakistan writes in, question is about Wade Barrett. He made a great start to his career with the Nexus and was in WWE's championship picture for a while. He became a serious contender, but after the Nexus was dismantled, he cooled off. Even more when he was drafted to SmackDown, the guy has all the talent in the world, the look and the mic skills, so what's making him wait? Also, regarding Daniel Bryan, just tell me what the hell are they doing with their Money in the Bank winner? As far as Barrett is concerned, he's got all the tools, absolutely. I won't deny that. He's got the size they like, he's got a good look. He's a pretty good wrestler. You know, he's not great, but he's not horrible or anything like that. And Mike skills, not a problem for him. He's a master on the microphone. It's actually quite amazing how quickly he took to that when he was out there as part of the Nexus every week cutting those promos. My guess would be that, you know, he had his moment as a main eventer, and WWE wanted to, move him back down to try to, I don't want to say make him pay his dues, but he kind of had his moment in the sun, and it passed. And I think eventually he'll come back around. He's a talented guy. You can't keep a guy like that down, you know. He's too good for that. So I'm sure at some point he's going to have championship gold around his waist again. As far as Daniel Bryan is concerned, I guess, like I said before, it's WWE's sick, twisted way of getting people over. You know, Daniel Bryan has to pay his dues first. And it kind of reminds me of Test, in a way. You know, Andrew Martin, when he was Test back in 1999. He had all the momentum in the world. He beat Shane McMahon in that SummerSlam lover or leave her match and was supposed to marry Stephanie McMahon. And they did the whole deal where Triple H ended up stealing Stephanie, which you think would lead to a feud between Test and Triple H, which never happened. And Test was never the same after that. He was one of those guys that had a lot of potential and was getting a big push right out of the gate. And they just killed him dead. They just killed him dead because I guess in their warped little minds, you know, the guy has to pay his dues first. And to me, he was just never the same after that. And I hope that Daniel Bryan doesn't suffer the same fate as somebody like Test, who had all the momentum in the world. He had people cheering him. He had people behind him. And still does to some degree. But you beat somebody too many times long enough. And I don't even remember if Test went on any kind of losing streak. But basically, you just take somebody's momentum and just kill it. And after a certain period of time, people are just not going to look at that person the same way. And my fear is that he could walk around with the briefcase all he wants to, but people do not look at Daniel Bryan as a guy worthy of main eventing WrestleMania right now. They've got time. They're going to have to rehabilitate him somehow and get him, really just get him to matter to people and come off as something important. Otherwise, you know, you put him in a championship match at WrestleMania, not that that's going to be the main event. Obviously, it's not, but nobody's going to give a shit. So you've got to get people between now and March to give a shit about seeing Daniel Bryan challenge, let's say, Mark Henry or Randy Orton for the World Heavyweight Championship. Nissim writes in with two quick questions here, coming off Vengeance. Are Dolph Ziggler and Cody Rhodes the next John Cena and Randy Orton? God, I hope not. How could you possibly say something so horrible about those two guys? Ziggler's upside is great. Ziggler's awesome. He comes off as a star. He's great in the ring. Do I trust WWE to give him a ball and run with it? No. Cody Rhodes also is pretty good. But again, the stupid mask, the way they make him talk. Unless they change that, these two guys are only going to be at a certain level. They're not going to get any higher than they are. Unless WWE gives them a chance to. And I wouldn't say the next Cena or Orton or the next Austin and Rock. I just think when you do shit like that, it's unfair to the young guys. Because you're giving them mighty big shoes to fill. Let them be who they are, and in 5 years, if you know they're a main event player, then hopefully they'll get over on their own and they won't be compared to John Cena and Randy Orton. God knows we don't need two guys like John Cena and Randy Orton on the roster. We already have Cena and Orton. We don't need any more of them. Second question here, is Mark Henry going to drop the belt to Big Show in Madison Square Garden? I sure hope not. I thought it was the wrong move to make when Big Show beat Brock for the championship at Survivor Series in the Garden, and I think it would be every bit as bad, if not worse, if he beat Mark Henry for the title at the pay-per-view as well. Anish writes in with a question about pay-per-view buys. Do you think if WWE were to reduce the cost of their pay-per-views, there would be more people buying them? Just came to mind after I saw a post on the SE Scoops Facebook page asking if people are going to buy the recent pay-per-view. Most of them said they would check it out online, but most of them do buy WrestleMania, apparently. So I guess if the cost was low, I think maybe people would respect that and there would be more buys. That is not the case, actually. There have been, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there are people that have actually studied this. And when WWE jacks up its prices, or at least, now I don't know if this applies now, because the prices have gotten a little too ridiculous. But for example, pay-per-views used to be $29.95. And when they jacked the price up to $34.95, which seems like a lifetime ago, the number of buys actually increased, believe it or not. Go back to 1997, okay? WWE would have their in-your-house shows, which were only 2 hours. Those were the in-between pay-per-views, okay? To supplement the Rumble and WrestleMania, SummerSlam, and Survivor Series. They were only 2 hours. And after SummerSlam that year, the first ever 3-hour non-major pay-per-view, which was Ground Zero, In Your House, in September of 97, 3-hour pay-per-view show, which means that the price of the show went up. And I don't remember exactly what it was. Maybe it was 30 bucks as opposed to 20 bucks or something like that. And WWE was not doing very well up until that point in 1997. When they made the change and the pay-per-views all went to 3 hours and the price got jacked up, more people bought the pay-per-views and WWE's business began to turn around. Now, granted, that was, what, 13, 14 years ago. Maybe the same logic doesn't apply, but I think it does. I think you reach a certain point where the pay-per-views are just way too expensive. Maybe we've reached that point. Maybe yes, maybe no. I think even for $44.95 non-HD, if you gave people a reason to buy these pay-per-views, they would do it. I mean, I still think you got to shave a couple more shows off. I think if you reduce the number from, let's say it's 13 now, down to like 8 or something, that would help. But there is no provable correlation between cutting pay-per-view prices and increasing buys. I don't think that's ever been proven to be the case. If anything, it's always been the opposite. Matt from Lincoln, Nebraska writes in, first-time writer but listener since episode 1. Wow, long-time follower here. I've enjoyed listening to your show every week without missing a single one for 4 years now, and I've enjoyed watching your following grow. Well, my interest in wrestling changes all the time. My interest in your show has not wavered. Keep up the great work. Also, my birthday is this weekend. I would love to get a shout-out on the show. If possible, your faithful follower and member of the Fantastic Four, Matt. Happy birthday, Matt. Hopefully, your birthday went well this weekend. That's a long-time listener there since episode 1. Got a lot of people like that out there. Speaking of which, got another email here from Frank. Was wondering if he, too, can get a birthday shout-out. He turned 20 back on October 27th. He, too, is a member of the Fantastic Four. He puts the hashtag winning after that. Well, hard to argue with that. Anyway, he said, what would be the positive and negative effects on... Oh, by the way, happy birthday, Frank, before I forget. What would be the positive and negative effects on WWE if Vince McMahon were to legitimately leave the company? I might have gone over this before. Nobody knows for sure. There's pros and there's cons. Again, on the one hand, you could say that Vince is a crazy old man. He changes his mind all the time. He's very anal and very obsessive-compulsive over certain things, to the point where people are in some cases, just downright miserable working for him. And the product suffers in the process when he micromanages the way that he does. So perhaps if Vince were to step aside and Triple H were to legitimately take over with Stephanie, maybe things would get better. You know, Triple H is an old-school kind of guy. Maybe he would take the product in a more old-school kind of direction and little things like not using the word belt and not saying the word wrestling too much would go to the wayside. Little things like that really aren't going to make a big difference in WWE. They've got bigger problems than that. I don't know, in seeing the way that Triple H has been booked as part of this whole CM Punk thing, and I don't know how much of the blame Triple H deserves for that. I'm sure he's got an influence. He is in the writing and production meetings, supposedly. Doesn't give me a lot of faith, quite frankly. Maybe not as much faith as I had before this whole angle started, just given the way that it's gone so far. But there are some people who think Triple H is going to be much better in that position, much easier to work with and more open to ideas and suggestions from other people than Vince might be. If that's the case, then that's one positive benefit. But on the other hand, Vince McMahon, for all of his faults, has run a very successful, very profitable wrestling company now for many, many years. He is going to go down, like him or not, as the most successful, the most prolific wrestling promoter in the history of the business. And there's a reason for that. You know, people say, well, Vince used to be a genius, now he's not. I don't know that Vince was ever a genius. I think Vince surrounded himself with smart people like Pat Patterson and, you know, Vince Russo back in the day, did his job well enough where he wrote something for the show that was kind of edgy and kind of different. Vince would fine-tune that And, you know, we saw a lot of that on TV in the late 90s. Of course, when Vince Russo was unfiltered in WCW and to a large degree in TNA, we saw what kind of writer and booker he really is. But, you know, Vince is the kind of person who could, even through bad times, you know, weather the storm business-wise. He can make certain changes. He can get rid of certain people. He could do certain things he needs to do to help keep his company profitable and weather the storm until things turn around. Now, it just so happens they've been in a rut for quite a while now. They're still a very profitable company. I don't cry for any of these people and the money they make. But wrestling's been cold now for a long time. You know, people love to say wrestling is cyclical. Even Jim Ross on the Bret Hart Shawn Michaels DVD at one point, he mentioned, you know, the wrestling business is cyclical. Maybe that's true to some degree, but I don't know. This must be a really long down cycle that we find ourselves in right now, because wrestling has not been hot for quite some time. And the CM Punk thing doesn't count. That was a one-month aberration. I'm talking about wrestling getting hot again for months or for a year or more and doing booming business. We have not seen that for a long time. Perhaps Vince McMahon has reached a point where he just can't be a very successful wrestling promoter anymore in 2011. Maybe time has passed him by. He's getting older. He's 66 years old. And he can't cut it the way that he used to. At some point, people get old. And the business and life and you know, pop culture and everything kind of passes them by. Vince is an old man. And yet, this is the guy that is supposed to have his pulse on what we, the fans, and especially the younger fans, are looking for in today's product. Maybe he just isn't the right guy for that anymore. Maybe Triple H isn't the right guy either. I don't know. So there's pros and cons. You know, Jim Ross, for example, would probably fare a hell of a lot better in WWE if Vince McMahon wasn't around. But, you know, it's just hard to say. There would be good, there would be bad. I think it would be scary for a little bit just because of the uncertainty. You don't know what you're getting with Triple H and Stephanie. They're still kind of a wild card. They've never actually been in control of the company before. They could end up being just as crazy and nuts as Vince McMahon, if not worse. So until that day comes, we really just don't know for sure. Luis writes in, ignoring the champion enters last tradition that WWE sometimes plays fast and loose with, what is the most effective match entrance order? Heel, then face, or face, then heel? Well, I'd say heel, then face, especially if you're building to a big match, if it's like a WrestleMania main event. I'm a big believer that the champion should come out last, even if you're the bad guy. But traditionally, I think the heel comes out first, the babyface comes out, gets the big reaction last. I think that probably is the way to go. That seems to make the most sense to me. Dylan Siraki writes in, part of the Fantastic Four, been listening since episode 124. Wanted to ask, when there is an angle on WWE TV and someone is sent to the back on a stretcher, then the camera shows them being driven away from the arena in an ambulance with WWE doctors, are they actually being taken to a hospital, or what happens? No, they are not taken to a hospital. I guess there have been times where guys have been legitimately injured, so I shouldn't say that it's never, ever happened, but typically when there's an angle, like take last Monday, for example, you know, Triple H is attacked by Kevin Nash, ultimately he gets loaded into an ambulance, they drove him away. He's not actually being driven to a medical center. He's being driven to a certain point until the camera guy yells cut, and then they come back. Or maybe they actually do pull away. Sometimes you'll see the ambulance actually drive out of the parking lot and away from the building, and then they'll probably just circle their way around and come back. In fact, I remember being at a WWE TV taping in, I can't remember if it was in Jersey. It might have been the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, and I don't remember exactly what the show or the angle was. It was a Raw taping, and as I recall, somebody was taken away in an ambulance, and I remember this would have been towards the end of the show, and I actually, we left, and I could see the ambulance. It was kind of weird, actually. I could see the ambulance kind of coming back to the building and pulling up to kind of the back of the arena where they were hoping they wouldn't be seen. And it was obvious it was the same ambulance that we had seen on screen. And that's typically the way it works. They don't actually go to the nearest medical center, which, by the way, I find it a little weird that WWE always calls it a medical facility. Why don't they just call it a hospital? That never really does make any sense to me. I guess hospital is on the list of banned terms in WWE. Got another question here. This is regarding WWE commercials. First order of business. Happy Halloween to all the Solomaniacs out there. Wanted to know what your favorite WWE commercial or advertisement was. I finally remember the one from the late 90s where aliens had a ship in Earth's orbit. They were going through world's TV channels looking for something that would be worthy enough for them not to destroy the planet. They finally stumbled onto WWE programming and decided to spare us due to its merits. I've tried to find this online since, but have not. Another one was the clip they made for Psycho Sid after he attacked someone, I think Shawn Michaels brutally, with what I remember to be a camera. It went like, oh, Psycho Sid, see what you did. It was great. They don't make shit like that now. Honestly, my favorite commercial, I thought the first Super Bowl commercial they did back in 99 was kind of clever. It was, different wrestlers kind of walking through the halls of Titan Tower, and it ends with Vince McMahon outside, and you see Titan Tower in the background, and somebody being thrown out of a window, and Vince looks in the camera and goes, get it? Because that was during the Attitude Era. I thought that was a good commercial, but my favorite commercial, it wasn't even really a WWE commercial. I guess it kind of was, but it was a commercial for Stacker 2. And there was a period of time where Kane was doing the commercials for Stacker 2, and it was Kane and this fat guy who may have been Big Dick Johnson. I'm not sure. I probably wasn't him. But the guy kind of reminded me of Big Dick Johnson. It was this heavyset guy. And Kane is in a supermarket, and he's waiting in line. And the fat guy, I guess, is in line ahead of him, and he looks back, and he sees Kane, and he says, Kane! He says, this is the express line. Can't you count? And he starts to count, and Kane just reaches for him. As the guy goes to get away from Kane, he made this really kind of effeminate pose, and I don't know. The way the commercial was shot, you got to see it. It's funnier if you watch it. I love that commercial. I don't know why. I just always laughed whenever I would see that commercial. So that would probably be my favorite. This comes from Dakota in Killeen, Texas. Hey, Solid Monster, great stuff on the Jay Lethal interview. Personally, I wish ROH was global like WWE. I hate having to watch their videos on YouTube. Anyway, great product, so I'm not going to bitch. I was wondering if my mom and I could get birthday shout-outs. Our birthdays are Monday and Tuesday. I was her 16th birthday present. She loves listening to the sound off with me late on Sundays. As always, keep up the good work and happy Halloween. So happy birthday to Dakota Maxwell and his mom down in Texas. Hopefully you guys have a happy and safe Halloween tomorrow. Harold writes in, if one day John Cena walked into Vince McMahon's office and said, Vince, if you don't become more violent, get blood, let us swear, CM Punk, Triple H, and I walk from this company and never come back, do you think Vince would say, okay, let's go to PG-13, or fine, get out of my office? Well, whatever Vince says, I'm sure the first thing he would probably do is ask John to stand up and get up off his knees so that he can talk to him face to face. And after he does that, he would basically laugh in his face and tell him to get out. I mean, let's be serious now. Come on. That's going to do it for this spooky edition of the Mailbag. If you have questions, don't be afraid. Email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. All one word, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Any questions, comments, or the like for me, or for this mailbag, for this show, goes to that address. And remember, you can email questions for the main page, SE Scoops Mailbag, to seScoops@gmail.com. A new mailbag actually went up on Friday and has instigated some of the, most passionate discussion and debate in the comment section, perhaps, of any mailbag. I think we were close to 70 comments at last count, so get in on that. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster. That's at Solomonster, I guess, on Twitter. Friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Of course, you could also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. And as I asked earlier, if you could leave some feedback, leave a review for the show on iTunes, I would be very much appreciative of that. And find me on YouTube. My account name on there is TheSolomonster. All one word, there's no spaces, TheSolomonster. Next week, for those of you who are not aware, is the four-year anniversary of the Sound Off. The very first Sound Off was on Tuesday, November 6th, 2007. It was the day after Raw, and I can't believe it's been 4 years. It's just completely ridiculous, but it is. And I got a little special surprise for you guys. Not on the show. There should be a fresh new show next week, but in addition to that, there'll be a little surprise, and for those of you who are not currently YouTube subscribers, you might want to get on YouTube right about now. This might be a good time to subscribe. That way, when a new video goes up, you'll be the first to know about it. You'll get a notification. I'll also be sure to post about it on Twitter and Facebook, so you don't have to worry about that. But definitely get on there if you are not already on there. That's my only warning to you, so go ahead and do that. So, until next time, next week will be the four-year anniversary of the Sound Off. I want to thank each and every one of you for your continued support. Without you listening to the show and and passing word along to your friends and trying to get your friends and your significant others and your relatives and all that to listen, even if they don't want to. Believe it or not, we've made a lot of new fans that way. People who were in some cases held up against their will, maybe in a car, on a long car ride or something, but they've become fans of the show. So thank you for that. Again, if you haven't checked out episode 187, it was my double interview. I interviewed independent wrestler Nathan the Prodigy Banner and the reigning Ring of Honor World Television Champion, former six-time X Division TNA Champion Jay Lethal. I want to thank Khalid for helping set that whole thing up. It's a great interview. And Jay was very candid in some of his comments, particularly about TNA. So if you didn't see the interview, go back and check it out. It's also on YouTube, episode 187. Till next time, be well, stay safe. And for those of you who are going trick-or-treating tomorrow night, have a very happy and spooky Halloween.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on scoops.com.